waiting to take that person's place. Dennis usually drove to Baltimore with his best friend, Jesse Bulstridge, Christy's son. Sometimes the pair stopped by the city health department's syringe exchange van to pick up clean needles. Once, when Jesse was away at rehab, Dennis made the trek to Baltimore with friends of friends, only to be robbed and ultimately abandoned by the people in his carpool. His girlfriend had to pick him up late that night, fuming, their toddler twins asleep in the back seat. Jesse and Dennis had been best friends since they were toddlers. "I have pictures of us together as three-year-olds playing in a sandbox," Dennis told me. They'd been partying together since the age of 16, when Jesse began trading his ADHD medication for painkillers. Whereas at the start of DC's heroin ring in late 2012, Jesse still preferred injecting crushed-up Roxys, Dennis said. His friend's drug of choice soon became IV heroin because it was cheaper and stronger, and suddenly it had become much easier to get. As their cravings grew in 2013, their parents paid for them to get residential treatment in separate out-of-state facilities, only to watch them fall back into using shortly after they returned and reunited. "The first time Jesse shot up heroin," his mother told me, "it was with drugs Dennis bought from one of DC's sub-dealers." Police officers and prosecutors working the case told me they can count on one hand the number of heroin users in the region before DC arrived. But Dennis and others familiar with heroin in Woodstock contend there were more. Dozens of young 20-somethings from Woodstock had already been driving to Baltimore to buy heroin, some making the trip twice a day. One night in late March 2013, Sergeant Lutz got a lucky break from an unlikely source. A minor traffic stop in neighboring Middletown, population 1,320. A traffic cop had pulled over the driver of a 2008 Hyundai Elantra for a broken license plate light and smelled marijuana wafting from his car. The moment the officer returned to his cruiser, Devin Gray floored the Hyundai before the policeman could piece together that Gray was driving on a suspended license or that he was an armed career criminal who went by the street name D, with several felonies on his record, including multiple convictions for assault and battery, smuggling drugs into a prison, and felony cocaine trafficking. In the course of Gray's 42 years, his only legitimate employment, police later learned, had been a stint at George's Chicken that ended a few months before, and he was one of D.C.'s and New York's key distributors. Neither did the Middletown cop know that Bill Medcalf, an agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, had already been pursuing Gray for the past 3 weeks, arranging undercover buys from him in the parking lots of Pizza Hut, Target, 7-Eleven, and Petco in several northern Shenandoah Valley towns. During the Petco buy, Gray had ridden shotgun with a girlfriend who had her 2-year-old in the back seat. Medcalf surreptitiously captured the buys on video from his vehicle and supplemented the visual record with an audio wire he tucked into the clothes of his confidential informant. Medcalf had been called into the case a month earlier by a detective buddy in Front Royal, a half hour east of Woodstock, who explained that Gray was carrying guns in violation of his probation terms. Lutz had teamed with Medcalf before on cases and admired his ability to work all night and keep going the next day. He told me, "ATF agents are the street cops of the federal world. They're a different breed and very much more gung-ho than we're allowed to be. The Obama administration is trying to rein them in a little. If there aren't guns connected to a case, they want them to pull back. But ATF agents want to work. They're like, call us, call us, call us." Every officer and prosecutor involved in the sprawling D.C. investigation used the same word to describe Medcalf, relentless. Frequently, they used the same phrase, "He can be a pain in the ass." "We've almost come to blows a couple times," said Sergeant Kevin Kaufman, the Front Royal officer who alerted Medcalf to Gray's guns. The two cars screamed as fast as 90 miles an hour. Gray led the local officer on a squealing chase through Middletown, a one-stoplight hamlet, down a scenic byway across I-81, and into neighboring Strasburg. On the southern edge of Strasburg, Gray abruptly stomped his brakes, causing the cruiser to ram the tail of the Hyundai and veer into an embankment before skidding and coming to rest on its side. The wreck left the officer with minor injuries. His police dog, a black lab named Trooper, broke loose and ran frantically around the totaled car, his training toys strewn across the street. While the officer extricated himself from the vehicle, Gray drove away, then abandoned his Hyundai and took off on foot, less than a mile from the field where Jesse Bulstridge had made his hometown football fans stand and roar. The case was sprouting new tentacles by the day. As it stretched across state and county lines, Metcalf called in a federal prosecutor from Roanoke who specialized in heroin cases, and a grand jury was eventually convened. The prosecutor's Obama-era marching orders, according to a roadmap written by then-Attorney General Eric H. Holder, Jr., was to use discretion in filing criminal charges, reserving the harshest penalties for serious high-level and/or violent drug traffickers. Responding to a nearly six-fold increase in the national prison population between 1972 and 2008, Holder wrote, "Too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for truly no good law enforcement reason." This case seemed to fit all the criteria. It targeted the biggest dealers. But to get the worst offenders off the streets, investigators typically need witnesses in the form of user dealers. It's a messy and often dangerous business in which police try to glean evidence in witness testimony from lower-level offenders in exchange for what's called substantial assistance. The unofficial interviews are not typically part of the public record, giving prosecutors and law enforcement officers alike a great deal of discretion over which witnesses to believe and which to target for the harshest punishment. With a fugitive hit and run now among his list of offenses, Gray was definitely in the mid-level category. The day after the high-speed chase, he reached out from his hideout in a tiny town near the base of Shenandoah Mountain to the same informant Metcalf used for the earlier drug buys. Gray was desperate to buy a gun. On the day of the chase, he had left the house without his usual complement of weaponry. Metcalf was eager to do the undercover deal. Within a week, a new setup was arranged to focus on Gray, a Florida native with a history of evading police. Metcalf arranged to meet Gray and trade him a gun for heroin. The deal would take place in a local storage facility, a public space with long rows of buildings and surrounding fences, easy to surround at a moment's notice by throngs of federal and local police. "My story was, I was recently out of jail and cleaning out my storage bin," Metcalf recalled. "I had some guns there, and I was trying to get back on my feet by trading guns for dope." A stocky guy with graying temples and piercing eyes, Metcalf grew out his trim beard for the occasion and wore a wire to capture the quick exchange. As soon as it was finished and Metcalf walked away, federal agents swarmed in to place Gray under arrest. From the moment he was in handcuffs, he cooperated with authorities. "I can give you the name of the guy who controls everything," Gray offered, according to Metcalf and other officers working the case. It was a huge moment, albeit a messy one, relying as it usually did on joining forces with one criminal to nab another. "In the end, they all sing," is how Metcalf told the story. But desperate people often lied to reduce their prison time, and there were a lot of people crooning some discordant, self-interested tunes. "He went by the nickname DC," Gray told Metcalf, but his real name was Ronnie Jones. While Jones controlled the heroin supply in the northern Shenandoah Valley, Metcalf would later learn, Kareem Shaw, a.k.a. New York, controlled the supply east toward the northern Virginia bedroom communities closer to Washington. Their dope was Mexican, trafficked by a Dominican dealer who ran a lab somewhere in Harlem. Agent Metcalf and Sergeant Lutz now knew not only D.C.'s name, but also where he lived, in a low-income apartment on the outskirts of Woodstock. His drug ring trafficked in seven counties, and federal authorities were on their way to proving he was the largest heroin trafficker along Virginia's I-81 corridor, and possibly in the state. In the small towns that dotted the region, Jones's business model was wholly new. Metcalf said, "When you get someone like Ronnie coming in here with real weight, that's far beyond a bunch of users piling into a car to go to Baltimore for the day." But a black man in an almost entirely white town driving a Mercedes SUV, even if it wasn't flashy? That was harder to camouflage than the smell of the chicken plant. "When big dealers come into small towns, they don't last long because they get talked about a lot," said Don Waltice, the assistant U.S. attorney who directed the prosecution of the case. "Not much time elapses before their customers become involved with police who catch the addicted users stealing stuff or robbing banks to afford their next buy. They get dimed out real quick," he said. The drug dealer's dilemma is always, how do I market myself and remain invisible simultaneously? Metcalf alerted Lutz to Jones's identity, only to learn that Lutz had just identified him through another Georgia's Chicken diversion worker, Logan, nicknamed Lo, Rose, who sold Jones's heroin from a Honda Civic with gold rims that really did stand out. He had been Jones's stick man or driver on occasions when he couldn't find a mule and had to personally replenish his Harlem supply. Jones wasn't allowed to leave the state without his probation officer's permission. Before Lutz could move in for the arrest, Rose fled to his native Puerto Rico, where federal marshals caught up with him a few days later. They found him sitting on a wall in front of his mother's tiny shack, eating a bowl of cereal. When the marshals phoned with news of Rose's arrest, Lutz was stunned. "We're like, Puerto Rico? You're kidding me, but that's so far away." It was so far away, in fact, that Rose had forgotten it was a territory of the United States, complete with its own federal law enforcement offices. While Brent Lutz was memorizing Jones's driver's license photo and Bill Metcalf was learning about his gun, a Taurus 357 revolver nicknamed the Decapitator, Ronnie D.C. Jones confided in his neighbor, Marie, one of his user dealers and one of the many women with whom he kept company. When Jones or his runners went to New York to resupply, Marie later told investigators, 200 people I know of would get sick or go into withdrawal. They could not wait for Jones to get back, and when he got back, everybody was better. "You can't blame Ronnie for everything," Marie told me. "We're the ones who stuck the needle in our arms. But we didn't have heroin available to buy here in town till Ronnie came. What he did ruined a lot of people's lives," she said, ticking off a long list of names. By importing heroin to a small town in bulk, Jones was able to make twice what the dealers in Baltimore and other cities were making. He made so much that he stockpiled new clothes in his new apartment, discarding them after a single wearing. He had a security system installed so that when he opened his front door, a woman's chipper recorded voice intoned, "Front door, open." He kept a personal trainer on call for workouts. He hired a designer to create a logo for an all-natural skincare line he hoped to sell. He wore gold chains, outfitted his girlfriends in new clothes. One kept her own stacks of new Lucky brand jeans in his apartment and told people he followed the motto of rapper Biggie Smalls, "Never get high on your own supply." As the task force charted out Jones's ring, pinning photographs on police department walls with street names to keep everybody straight, Metcalf turned to Lutz. The goal before had always been to stop the small-town dealers. This case was larger and more complex than any conspiracy they'd worked before. Maybe it was possible this time even to bring down the source. "Man," Metcalf said, "this reminds me of The Wire." Lutz hadn't heard of the show, but watching it later with his fiance, he agreed. Thinking about the exponential scope of Jones's impact, a trail of addiction that would not be contained in all likelihood for many years, both men seethed. "We were starting to have 18-year-olds overdose," Lutz remembered. "We were disgusted with what he was doing to our town." Before 2013 was over, overdose deaths in the region would surge to 21, up from a single death in 2012. Heroin was so wildly lucrative that even mid-level dealers in the ring could make $15,000 in a single weekend. Metcalf and Lutz interviewed an addicted user dealer from Stafford County, 31-year-old Kimberly Hodston, who was dating Kareem Shaw and going on regular trips with him to Harlem to test the potency of the heroin before he bought it. On one trip, Shaw got mad at Hodston when she declined his initial offer to buy her a $400 pair of pants from a swanky Manhattan store. It was heady stuff for a local girl, a high school dropout who'd been shuffled among her mother, grandmother, and a local shelter. Hodgson's name and picture were pinned halfway down the growing chart, the words "Crash Test Dummy," Shaw's pet name for her, inked beneath her mugshot. And Hodgson had a tiny clue about the New York supplier to share. He went by the nickname Mac. Jones controlled the left or western side of the chart, while Shaw's name went on the eastern side of the ring, on the right. Low-level informants dealing only to support their habit were at the bottom of the pyramid, including some whose names would eventually get crossed out due to overdose death. The chart eventually earned an unusual nickname thanks to an interview between Metcalf and one of Shaw's lieutenants, Keith Marshall, in jail for possession of illicit pills. Addicted to opioids since the age of 16, Marshall was a functioning heroin addict from Baltimore who'd managed to keep a job for 15 years as a worker for Payne's Tree Service in Stafford before getting ensnared in the Jones-Shaw ring. His lawyer told me he'd overdosed 5 times and had been in and out of jail for petty theft and possession charges most of his adult life. In a letter from a North Carolina prison, Marshall himself wrote, "I've done tree work, tended bar, did graphic design for a studio up in Manhattan, among other jobs. I've had 20 grand stashed in my house for the re-up, and I've lived in a tent in the woods because I was so far gone on dope." Scheduled to be jailed on possession charges in mid-2013, stemming from an earlier state charge, Marshall said he returned to dealing because he wanted to make extra money in preparation for going to jail. He had debts to pay off, and he wanted to have money on his jail account for toiletries and food. His lawyer, Dana Cormier, told me, "Marshall started dealing for Kareem Shaw to take care of business before he went away for a year for the possession conviction. Jones and Shaw were living the life, but almost everyone underneath them, Keith Marshall included, were junkies distributing just to supply their own habit." Metcalf waited until Marshall went to jail for the 2013 state charges to interview him, carefully, about his role in Shaw's network. "You don't want to reveal too much of your case," Metcalf explained. "You just want to poke around and see if they'll talk." But Marshall refused, steadfastly and defiantly. "Guys, I could have given you the biggest dealer supplying Stafford County, but I'm not giving you shit," Marshall told him. Already surveilling Marshall's dealer, Kareem Shaw, now operating out of cheap motels along Route 11, Metcalf was fishing, trying to see if Marshall knew anything that would help him peel another layer from the onion, maybe a detail about the New York source. He challenged Marshall to tell him everything he knew, but Marshall refused. "What if we have proof you're already involved in the federal case and we come back here with a warrant?" Metcalf challenged. Marshall was sure Metcalf was bluffing, convinced he would have already indicted him if he had the evidence, Marshall later told me from prison. "Mr. Metcalf, unfortunately, is a man of his word," he said, referring to the additional federal distribution charges Metcalf returned with 6 months later, which resulted in another sentence for 5 years. But at the time, Marshall leveled a cold stare at his interviewer and ended the conversation with a clipped, "Fuck you, bring it." Back at the prosecutor's office, Waltice now had a name for the worst drug ring in the region's history. Above his chart, topped with the names of Ronnie Jones and Kareem Shaw, he took out a Sharpie and wrote in black capital letters, "FUBI, F-U-B-I. It just resonated," he said. Chapter 8. Shit Don't Stop. The Ronnie Jones arrest, when it finally came in June 2013, was almost anticlimactic. Poetic, just about, the way it featured the usual cascade of drug bust interactions. An informant tip, followed by a recorded buy, that led to one of Jones's main sub-dealers, a former Marine who'd been kicked out of the Corps for alcohol-related charges before spiraling into heroin addiction. In the end, all Bill Metcalf had to do was track the movements of Joshua Pettyjohn, the ex-Marine, as he bought 20 grams of heroin from Jones and then drove away. Pettyjohn would warble a detailed tune, confessing immediately after police arrested him in possession of heroin. Jones had known he was hot, a police target. A month earlier, Brett Lutz and other task force officers swooped in on his Woodstock apartment complex on Lakeview Drive, only to find that he'd decamped to one of the two other apartments he was also keeping, one with a girlfriend in Dumfries and the other one in Front Royal, closer to Kareem Shaw. He drove a decidedly less flashy Chevy Impala when he drove to Woodstock, reserving the Mercedes for non-dope activities. Police called the Front Royal apartment they'd been surveilling, a vinyl-sided three-floor unit just off Main Street, the Man Cave. They suspected it was where the Pringles pucks were now being re-rocked or broken down. To lower his profile even more, Jones changed cell phone numbers and started parking several blocks away from his apartments. He also transitioned his operation from a brew-through, as Don Waltice called it, selling at his apartment, to just about any buyer who showed up, to dealing only with a handful of sub-dealers. He was trying to distance himself from his buyers and therefore, he hoped, from arrest. At the Lakeview raid, Lutz and his colleagues arrested Marie instead, along with four others near the bottom of the FUBI chart. Marie spent 7 months in the county jail on charges of heroin possession, a probation violation from an earlier Suboxone distribution charge, and child endangerment. "My daughter, she's 7 now, and she still has bad dreams about the night the cops kicked in our door," she told me in 2016. "We spooked him," Lutz recalled of Jones. Jones had been so positive that Marie would sing that his expression barely changed 6 weeks later when more than 24 state, federal, and local officers descended to place him under arrest. Lutz would never forget the moment he first eyed through binoculars from the Chinese restaurant next door the guy whose picture he'd fixated on for months. "He had the look like he wasn't surprised," Lutz said, an assessment Marie echoed when she remembered Jones telling her months before, "If I have a good run, it'll last 3 months. If I have a great run, I can make it 6. Jones had been bringing bulk heroin to Woodstock for exactly 6 months. During that time, not only had overdose deaths surged, but so had non-fatal overdoses, the number of children entering foster care due to parental opioid abuse, and the cases of children born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, all at roughly 5 times the previous year's rate. Once they had Jones in handcuffs, Metcalf wanted to pounce. He gathered as much evidence as possible from Jones's apartment before word of his arrest reached the other dealers in the ring. The day was filled with hurry up and wait, too much waiting, not enough hurrying, in Metcalf's view, as search warrant requests slogged their way out to local judges in several localities for everything from Jones's residences to his vehicles to the homes of other members in the ring. Jones stonewalled throughout, initially telling Metcalf he didn't have an address and then giving him the wrong apartment number when he did. Judges require police to offer an exact address before issuing a warrant. Lutz arrested Pete Butler and Charles Smith in their respective homes near George's Chicken, while Kevin Kaufman and Metcalf surveyed Jones's apartments, where they confiscated copious amounts of heroin, crack, firearms, and cash. They finally located his Dumfries apartment after finding an estimate for a repair bill in his name at the apartment in Front Royal. Later that day, when Metcalf finally got his first close-up look at Ronnie Jones in a county jail interviewing room in Front Royal, he found him to be very smug, very arrogant, he said. The feeling was mutual. "He was very aggressive. He harassed people," Jones said of Metcalf. Jones hated him for delivering a subpoena to the mother of his oldest child, at work, embarrassing and intimidating her, he said, and for interviewing Jones's mom. His younger brother, Thomas Jones, told me the family had no idea Ronnie was a big-time heroin dealer until they heard about it on the news. Their mother was deeply embarrassed by it and did not wish to be interviewed, he said. She had seen him only a week before his arrest. Ronnie stopped by her house in the northern Virginia suburbs to chat after delivering cupcakes to his daughter's school. Ronnie told his family he'd been running his own computer repair shop, fixing broken laptops, iPads, and cell phones. He even showed them a logo he had prepared for the business called New to You. Metcalf and Jones hated each other instantly, but they had more in common than either of them knew. Metcalf, 44 in mid-2013, had worked gang cases in L.A. and drugs in Washington. "From my perspective, in the cities, you take off one drug dealer and they're not even missed, there's so many," he said. "But this was truly the front lines. You shut down somebody like Ronnie Jones, somebody who's making the whole town dope sick, and you're really making an impact." If he could get Jones or the other FUBI consorts to give up their Harlem source, the effects would be more widespread. The quest had become deeply personal. The worst event in Bill Metcalf's life had taken place almost 4 decades earlier on a hot summer night when he was 7 years old. He was seated at the dinner table with his parents and older sister when he noticed a police officer running outside the window with his gun drawn. "Go to your room," Bill's mother told the kids. What Bill didn't know then was that his father was a heroin-addicted drug trafficker and that his mother felt she had no option other than cooperating with police to have him arrested. Metcalf remembered running down the stairs the night of the arrest, in time to see officers slam his father against a wall and handcuff him. His father looked at him, his head still pressed against the wall, and told him, "You're the man of the family now. Take care of your mother and your sister." Metcalf said he was more confused and intimidated by the order. He wondered, "How am I going to do this when everyone's so much taller than me?" His mom hustled him and his sister into her car and fled to her mother's house in Chapmanville, West Virginia, with just the clothes on their backs. His parents had met in the 1970s after his mother migrated from West Virginia to Baltimore for factory work. The family moved to Cleveland, chasing better factory jobs a few years later. His mom did piecework in a Cleveland textile factory, while his dad worked sporadically, constantly feeling the tug of his Baltimore hometown. His father and uncles were in and out of jail, and only the oldest brother of the five, his Uncle Bill, for whom Metcalf is named, was not a heroin user. There were always guys just out of prison showing up at our house, and when my dad's brothers moved to Cleveland, it got progressively out of control, he said. His father sometimes beat his mother, who felt so trapped that she ultimately informed on him to the police. It was her kid's one shot, Georgia Metcalf believed, for a peaceful life. As a child, Metcalf knew his father loved him. Even then, he understood that drugs were the primary driver of his family's instability. "I had seen my father nodding out into the spaghetti, and Mom was like, 'Daddy's sick,'" he recalled. When the anti-drug rhetoric of the mid-1980s emerged, he was an immediate convert, buying into the "This Is Your Brain on Drugs" ad campaign that featured the searing egg in an iron skillet. To this day, a six-pack of beer would expire in his refrigerator before it would occur to him to drink all six. "We stood in the cheese line," Metcalf recalled, of growing up in Chapmanville, where his mother worked two, sometimes three jobs before becoming one of the county's first female coal miners. The Salvation Army Santa Claus came to their house with Christmas gifts. When his mom died in 2015, mourners recalled how she had always stood up for the little guy, filling out black lung benefit forms for her co-workers and threatening to sue the company when she caught a coal mine manager throwing her and another woman's job applications in the trash. Asked if he was made fun of as a kid, Metcalf laughed. "Are you kidding? My grandmother chewed tobacco. Everyone at my school was in the same boat. No one had any money." Chapmanville was, in retrospect, another perfect breeding ground for the opioid epidemic, with OxyContin moving in just as most of the mines were shutting down in the late 1990s, and the only viable economic option beyond disability and illicit drug sales was joining the military, one that Metcalf took. He chose the Air Force because the recruiter promised he'd have a job in law enforcement waiting for him when he got out. Playing cops and robbers as a kid, he'd always insisted on being the cop. "I distinctly remember teachers skipping entire chapters in textbooks because, quote, 'You will not need this when you are working in the mines,' he told me in late 2016. It took precisely one visit to an active low coal mine for Metcalf to understand that his future wasn't at the bottom of one. The next county over, in tiny Kermit, West Virginia, Charleston Gazette-Mail reporter Eric Iyer had just won a Pulitzer for pointing out that Big Pharma shipped nearly 9 million hydrocodone pills to a single pharmacy in a town of just 392 people, giving Mingo County the fourth highest prescription opioid death rate of any county in America. Metcalf had seen it coming as early as 1997. Out of the country at the time, he was serving in the Air Force and hated the thought of missing his 10-year high school reunion, though the turnout was dismal. The chief organizer, a drug user, had absconded with the class reunion funds. "When everybody showed up, she wasn't there, and neither was the party," he said. By arresting Jones, Metcalf was not only doing his job, he was atoning for the sins of his father. His wife, though, was starting to complain about his obsession with Jones. He routinely worked till midnight or later, leaving her stranded at home with their four kids. With every new conspiracy chart, he promised he'd request a desk job after this case. "I spent one Thanksgiving on the hood of a car doing surveillance work," he said. He did not want to end up like Lutz, who'd recently split with his fiancée, partly due to conflicts over work. A former Air Force military police officer, his wife Jessica, understood the life. She'd witnessed how enraged her husband had been after arresting a user dealer in a traffic stop and finding heroin tucked into his baby girl's shoe, the smell of marijuana blanketing the inside of the car. But their kids were another story. One night in the middle of the Fubi case, Jessica drove them to the task force headquarters to see Metcalf, and his youngest daughter asked him plaintively, "Daddy, is this where you live?" He renewed his promise to his wife after this case. "Ronnie Jones was a predator, and the people in Woodstock were sheep to him," Metcalf told me. His desire wasn't just to be a big-time heroin dealer, he believed. It was also about money, control, manipulation. He created a market that didn't exist before, then he manipulated it to increase his profits, Metcalf said. And that's the problem with heroin and why I don't think it's going away. The money is insane, and the customers are always there. Bulk dealers like Mac, the New York supplier, manipulated Jones by adding their own diabolical spin to the scheme, designed to keep him returning for more. When Jones sent a runner up to Harlem to buy 200 grams of heroin for $13,000, rather than just give the mule what Jones paid for, Mac typically sent the runner home with double what Jones had ordered, 400 grams, plus a bill for an additional $14,000. Amounting to $5 extra per gram on the front of drugs. It was double the Pringles at a bargain interest rate, and Jones had no trouble selling the dope. The rule was the money had to be paid back to Mac via Western Union or MoneyGram before the next order could be placed. The arrangement not only contributed to the exponential growth in heroin and Woodstock and bigger profits for both Mac and Jones, it also created a paper trail that Metcalf could follow. They thought, "These country bumpkins will never figure this out," Metcalf said. With Shaw's supply side of the ring still operating, dozens more low- and mid-level user-dealer arrests were made as the summer of 2013 wore on, including in an Econolodge motel in Dumfries, where police found dealers setting up shop in a room and selling heroin stuffed into the false bottom of a can of Red Bull. As local task force officers staked out more deal-making hotspots, Metcalf tried to home in on Mac. Walt Heiss plotted out the officer's progress on the Fubi chart as one arrest led to another. Every time another person was jailed, Walt Heiss tallied the offense by the weight of the drugs sold in grams and by the dosage unit, the number of times someone stuck a needle in his or her arm. One low to mid-level dealer ended up with a 5-year sentence for selling the equivalent of between 6,400 and 14,400 needles worth of dope. Metcalf wanted badly to arrest Jones's main girlfriend in Dumfries. He'd found the decapitator loaded in a safe in her apartment next to a concealed carry permit in her name. Surely she was also complicit in not just going to the movies, as she claimed, as Jones's heroin made its way to farmers' kids and high school football stars. Did she really buy Jones's story about fixing computers at the local library? Didn't she realize what paid for all those new Lucky Brand jeans? Walt Heiss, the prosecutor, had to keep reminding Metcalf, "There's this thing the courts require, Bill. It's called evidence." The E word became part of their banter, with Walt Heiss drawing a giant E on a piece of paper and telling Metcalf to stick it to the ceiling above his bed. By the time the case wrapped up the following year, with 66 people prosecuted in state courts and 18 convicted federally, Metcalf presented Walt Heiss with a homemade award, a glass-encased can of cheddar cheese Pringles with a single word on the trophy nameplate, evidence. In a corner of Walt Heiss's desk, not far from the trophy, he still keeps an old case file open. Experience tells him that the September 2013 death of Jesse Bulstridge, once the Strasburg Rams defensive star, was connected to the Fubi ring, but the shards of evidence have never fully formed into a whole. "I don't forget this one," he said. Walt Heiss, 61, is known for litigating death cases, prosecutions of suppliers in which a person has died as a direct result of that dealer's drug. From his perch in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Roanoke, the same office that prosecuted Purdue Pharma, he's indicted heroin dealers for decades, long enough to witness the transition from a small, fairly quiet group of mostly black and middle-aged users in the mid-1990s to a much larger, younger, and whiter group. One of his first death cases involved a 13-person conspiracy brought to his attention when police found a middle-aged woman slumped over on a chair inside her apartment door shortly after she'd shot up in the bathroom of a Kentucky Fried Chicken. She was sitting on a claw hammer when the officers found her. They just left her there all alone to die, he said. Her friends had propped her up in the chair, he remembered, placed atop the randomly discarded tool. Another woman prosecuted in that same heroin conspiracy sent her child to the door to deliver the heroin because she was nodding out in her bedroom and couldn't get up. There's just something so fundamentally soul-sucking about heroin, Waltheis said. He said he was still just waiting for something to fall from the sky in the Jesse Balstridge case. The timeline between the point of sale and his death was not airtight. Too much time elapsed between the time Jesse's best friend, Dennis Painter, bought the heroin and the moment Jesse died, some 18 hours later, and there were too many people with Jesse in the interim and too many other unknowns. Metcalf and Lutz believe Dennis bought the heroin from a local user dealer originally supplied by people in the Jones-Shaw ring. But such death cases are hard to prove in the fluid realm where most overdoses occur, and resources are limited. We don't have the capacity to try everyone involved in a ring of hundreds of people, Waltheis said, but we do try to cut the heart out of the monster. Christy Fernandez was already scared when a homesick Jesse begged to come home for the weekend from an Asheville sober house in May 2013 against his counselor's advice. She worried that weekend, too, when he disappeared for hours at a stretch with Dennis. She liked Dennis and still has pictures of the two of them together playing in the sandbox at their preschool, Grasshopper Green. But she knew full well that Dennis had been in and out of drug rehab for heroin, and as far as she knew, Jesse's problem hadn't progressed to that. When Jesse returned to Asheville that Sunday night, he tested positive for marijuana, and per the contract he signed when entering the program, counselors booted him out. He had loved living there, telling his Facebook friends a month earlier, "I'm grateful to have such a big support group. I love all of my family and friends. They're the best." And, "So glad to be sober on this date, 93 days. Those same supportive counselors advised Christy not to welcome Jesse home after his dismissal, but she took him in anyway. "I don't regret that," she says. "I was not going to leave my 18-year-old son in a different state with nowhere to live." And unlike Jamie Waldrop, the Roanoke mother and surgeon's wife, Christy could not afford to spend thousands sending her son immediately to another rehab or flying with him to make sure the transfer stuck. Christy had already sent Jesse to a rehab in Jacksonville once in January 2013, a 10-week treatment regimen that began with intensive counseling and medical detox, during which Jesse briefly took buprenorphine, more commonly known by the brand name Suboxone, a partial opioid agonist designed to stem cravings. Jesse still owed $25,000 for that earlier rehab stint, even though he was on his mother's insurance, paying $25 a week that he had auto-deducted from his checking account. He was weaned off Suboxone after 3 weeks, a not uncommon practice that would become increasingly controversial as the treatment became more prominent. As Nora Volkov, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA, told me in January 2016, "To be clear, the evidence supports long-term maintenance with these medicines in the context of behavioral treatment and recovery support, not short-term detoxification programs aimed at abstinence." NIDA, the Institute of Medicine, the World Health Organization, and the White House Drug Czar's Office would all agree that indefinite and maybe even lifelong maintenance treatment is superior to abstinence-based rehab for opioid use disorder. And even Hazleton, the Betty Ford-affiliated center that originated the concept of the 28-day rehab, changed its stance on medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, offering Suboxone to some patients in 2012. But the rehab Jesse went to was aimed at abstinence, as most were then and now. "The whole system needs revamped," said Tracy Helton Mitchell, a recovering heroin user, author, and activist. "In the United States, we are very attached to our 12-step rehabs, which are not affordable, not standardized from one place to another, and not necessarily effective for the opioid addicted." Clearly, more recent data supports ongoing MAT, but there is a catch. One of the reasons people stay so hopeless about the epidemic is that in any given episode, they only see a small proportion of people get into remission, Harvard researcher John Kelly told me. What happens is it takes about 8 years on average after people start treatment to get 1 year of sobriety and 4 to 5 different episodes of treatment for that sobriety to stick. And many people simply don't have 8 years. After being kicked out of the sober living house in Asheville, Jesse moved back home and took a construction job with his father, commuting 90 miles one way to the D.C. suburbs, where they worked on a government contract and Jesse earned $1,000 a week. He was a good worker, he was pleasant to be around, and he lived rent-free with his mom. And so Christy was stymied later that summer when the overdraft notices from Jesse's bank started piling up. "I can't stop," he finally admitted to his mom. He was spending $200 a day on black market opiates, he told her, and asked for help returning to rehab in Florida. He was so high then that she refused to allow him to come home to protect his younger sisters. But she arranged for him to stay in a nearby town with her sister, who made him hamburgers that night and let him sleep on her couch. He used what she believed was the last of his money to buy an airline ticket to Jacksonville. He was 48 hours away from a do-over, the insurance and admissions paperwork already arranged. And yet Christy still didn't comprehend the depth of her son's addiction. "I hate to even say it, but I thought he was going back to rehab for just pills," she said. Jesse still looked like a linebacker after all. He was handsome and tanned. He hadn't missed a day of work at his construction job. She told me they'd leave at 4 a.m. and that's not easy work. He had plans to start community college in January 2014, then transfer to a 4-year university. His goal was to become a phys ed teacher, coach, or sports medicine trainer. He hungered still for the football field. The idea that her son was shooting up heroin hadn't crossed her mind, she said, then corrected herself. The truth was, the thought had crossed her mind. She just hadn't let it roost. Despite evidence to the contrary, despite having already padlocked her bedroom door to keep Jesse from stealing money for drugs, only later would she learn about the spent syringes found on the Port-a-John floor at the construction site where Jesse worked. Only later would she understand that Jesse lied about his dismissal from a warehouse job a year earlier. He swore he had nothing to do with the syringes his boss found in the bathroom, and Christy believed him. How could someone who looked that robust be addicted to heroin? It was late September 2013, and news of Jones's heroin ring hadn't yet appeared in the local press, though several arrests had already been made, and federal agents were working with local police from 7 counties to target the leaders of what they were privately calling one of the largest heroin rings in the state. The region's pill problem had become a full-fledged heroin epidemic in the span of just a few months, but the only ones to know about it, other than the addicted, were a handful of cops. That Friday night, 2 days before Jesse was scheduled to fly to a Jacksonville treatment center for his do-over, Dennis was deep in the throes of dope sickness when he and Jesse stole insulin needles from Jesse's grandmother and bought heroin. "I was puking," Dennis recalled of their last day together. "I told him, I was like, I gotta get this dope." "I'm not trying to do dope," said Jesse, who'd spent the summer injecting black market Roxy's. But the pills had worn off, and he, too, had been throwing up off and on all day. He tried eating his 2 favorite foods, McDonald's chicken nuggets and macaroni and cheese, but couldn't keep them down. As soon as Dennis made the buy, Jesse relented, deciding it would be his final hurrah before returning to rehab. They hosted a going-away party at a friend's house. Late that night, a mutual friend broke down crying when she saw Jesse shoot up in front of people. He'd never before been so open about his heroin use, she told me. But Jesse assured his friends that he liked the rehab he was returning to. Even though he missed his mom and twin teenage sisters, Jesse said, he liked being with people his age, going through the same struggle as he was. He hugged Dennis's girlfriend, Courtney Fletcher, and told her, "I promise, I'm going to be okay." The next morning, as several friends left to go four-wheeling, Jesse came out of the spare bedroom complaining of a headache. Courtney offered him Tylenol from her purse, but Jesse declined and returned to the bedroom, she said. 2 hours later, Dennis saw that Jesse's door was cracked open and went in to bum a cigarette. His bed was empty. A few steps away, Dennis found his best friend unconscious in the bathroom, slumped over the vanity, a needle stuck in his arm, and the belt he'd used to tie off with in a perfect circle on the floor. "What do I do?" he shouted, running back and forth between the living room and the bathroom, screaming and crying and grabbing his hair. Some friends quickly fled, chucking the drugs and the paraphernalia into the woods beside the house. Courtney was one of them. She said she ran because she feared her children would be removed by social service workers. She does not do drugs, she said, and her kids had been asleep in an upstairs bedroom throughout the party and were not exposed. Dennis called 911 and waited for police. By the time Lutz arrived, between 2 and 6 hours later, rigor mortis had set in. "I think there's still something they're not telling me," Christy says, about why Jesse's friends waited so long to call 911. "Jesse usually used pills instead of heroin, and I don't think he'd use alone. I'd feel better knowing that he was not alone when he died." Lutz remembered thinking how strange it was. Here was a fit, burly construction worker, a guy who just put in 40 hours of work that week, felled to the core by the diabolical drug. When a cell phone atop the bathroom vanity rang that morning, Lutz picked it up. It was a counselor calling Jesse to confirm his Sunday arrival time at the Jacksonville rehab. Over the next several weeks, Metcalf pounded Ronnie Jones with questions, trying to get him to reveal his source. But Jones denied being a drug dealer, denied that the confiscated guns and drugs belonged to him, and who the hell was Mac? It didn't help Jones's case that his gun, recovered from the Dumfries apartment, had Jones's DNA on it, as did another gun, reported stolen from a car in Woodstock. Or that Metcalf had multiple witnesses claiming that Jones threatened to kill them with it if they didn't pay off their drug debts. Police even recorded phone calls from Jones trying to coordinate drug pickups and sales from inside the jail. "Shit don't stop," he told one of his girlfriends. He wrote angry letters to people, telling Marie he still loved her but was mad that she dimed him to police. Above all, he wanted people to know he was not a snitch. "Arthur," he wrote, "I have been hearing a lot of foul shit lately from people you have spoke to," began one of his letters from jail. "I want to set the record straight. I never told or snitched on you. Never. After that nigga Logan Rose gave all that info to the feds, they still told him he would be charged, and he ran to Puerto Rico with his girl that he met at George's. Do you see me putting a bad bone out there for you for that shit? Hell no, because I'm going to wait till I see you face to face to ask you about it like a man. I don't want nobody fucking up my name or character in these streets or jails. If you got questions, just holla at me." Though most of the user dealers were happy to sing, it was code among the people at Jones's level to behave as if not only their dignity was at stake, but also their lives, which quite possibly they were. Not so with dealer Kareem Shaw, who was happy to pull back the curtain on the FUBI ring when the task force arrested him 4 months after Jesse's death. Best of all, he led Metcalf to a key piece of information, a face. "You saw the video, right?" he asked Metcalf. "What video?" An 80-minute production called Hell Up in East Harlem. It was a gritty, street-level documentary about a Harlem block plagued by gang violence during the crack epidemic of the late 1980s and 90s. It was all available on YouTube, and so, around minute 30, was the source of the tsunami of misery that descended on Woodstock a decade after the film was made. Seated on a bench for the camera, Mac wore a red hoodie. He bemoaned the fact that death in prison seemed too often to be the only avenues out of the loop of poverty and drugs. Appearing on camera had been a rookie mistake for the young, then low-level dealer, who described walking the block and seeing guts and brains. "That shit be like some real walking hell shit," he said. "Ends getting laid out." Shaw watched the video with Metcalf, and dutifully, in exchange for substantial assistance at sentencing time, he pointed out Mac. Though the filmmakers identified him only as Matt Doogie, Metcalf was thrilled to have a visual of his target. "Now I could hear his voice and see his mannerisms," he said. Still, not even Shaw, who was from New York City and forged the initial connection to Mac through a cousin, knew Mac's real name. He could, however, describe the general vicinity of the Harlem heroin mill where Mac stepped on or cut the pure tan powder, diluting it to extend their profits before re-rocking it into pucks. Metcalf now had more than enough proof to arrest Mack based on witness testimony and scores of cell phone exchanges among Jones, Shaw, and Mack. But where exactly was the apartment and who exactly was Mack? He felt as if he were being taunted by a ghost. Most agents would have written it off, but Metcalf was not going to leave it alone, Walteis said. In a city of almost 8.5 million people, now all Metcalf had to do was find the ghost. Mack had recently been released from prison. Metcalf knew that much. One witness remembered that when Jones first landed in Woodstock and struggled to buy bulk heroin, a friend had tipped him off to Mack. When my cousin gets out of prison, it's game on. He's got the connects. Mack was by now a pro with lawyers on retainer and a network of assistants. Earlier, when he learned that Jones threatened to shoot a customer if he didn't pay back his drug debt, Mack rebuked Jones, telling him, "Why would you do that? You're running a business. If you want to harm someone, don't do it yourself. We got people for that." But Mack didn't always make the best choices about which details to delegate and which jobs to personally execute. When Shaw paid Mack back for the heroin he'd fronted him, the payments were retrieved in cities across the country, in MoneyGram kiosks from New York to San Diego. Someone was picking up the money for Mack, and Metcalf figured out it had to be someone he trusted, a relative or girlfriend, perhaps. On federal probation, Mack wasn't allowed to leave the state without checking in with his probation officer. Late one night, working out of the Regional Drug Task Force office in Front Royal, in the upstairs bedroom of an unmarked house, Metcalf reached out to the security department at MoneyGram, read out the transaction numbers from the text messages, and ultimately came away with the woman's name and several seemingly random addresses in Brooklyn, Harlem, and the Bronx. He cross-referenced the addresses and found one that turned out to be legitimate. He was stunned when, the next morning, he ran that address through the city's probation and parole database and found a single match, a Brooklyn probationer named Matthew Santiago. It had to be Mack. The 37-year-old New York native had recently finished a 2-year prison stint for his part in a $2 million marijuana trafficking conspiracy. He'd gotten out of prison just a few weeks before Jones's business in Woodstock picked up. "What's he look like?" Metcalf asked the probation officer. "Black male with a beard." Metcalf asked for a picture via email, and a few minutes later, there he was on his computer screen, an older version of Matt Doogie. Metcalf now had everything he needed to arrest Mack, a name, a picture, and an address. The night before, it had occurred to Bill Metcalf when he was sorting through MoneyGram receipts that he was no better than his father. The work had become its own kind of addiction. "We're both chasing the same thing on different sides of the law," he said. He enjoyed the streets and friends over family and the pursuit of this lifestyle, and here I am chasing those guys and choosing that over my family. His wife wanted to try for a boy. It would be their fifth child after 4 girls. "It's one more jelly sandwich. Who cares?" she argued, begging him again to ask for a desk job. After he cut the heart out of the monster, he promised, he'd ask for a transfer. For the first time, he meant it. He found Mack outside his apartment building in Brooklyn, walking his dog. "Who are you? Where are you from?" Santiago wanted to know. "I'm an ATF agent from Virginia, and that's where you're going," Metcalf said. Santiago told him that he'd never been to Virginia, which may have been true. Santiago had 2 children. They would be 17 and 14 by the time his case rolled through a federal courtroom in Harrisonburg, Virginia, the following year. Judge Michael Urbanski would approve a plea deal negotiated after a series of meetings between Walteis and Santiago's lawyer, who incidentally had been at the Southern District of New York courthouse in Manhattan waiting for him on the day of his arrest. Metcalf said, "The elevators opened, and there was his lawyer. He'd already beaten us there." He believed the quick legal service signified high-level cartel connections. Walteis wasn't so sure, saying that the E-word, evidence, just wasn't there. Walteis said, "If Santiago was truly Mr. Big, why would he be selling to a couple of wahoos in a small Virginia town?" Santiago had tried to find work when he got out of prison, picking up odd jobs, his attorney wrote in his pre-sentence memorandum. But finding legitimate employment is exceedingly hard for felons, and the odd job income wasn't enough to provide for his family. So against his better judgment, he drifted back into criminal activity, his attorney noted. He deeply regrets his actions and is aware of the strict penalty he is about to face. He has let down his children and feels a greater sense of guilt and shame for his actions. His father was murdered when he was 4 months old, and Santiago, a high school dropout, grew up mired in poverty, the report said. In his late 20s, he ran a small party and event planning company called Self-Made and worked freelance as a music video stylist. Compared with Jones, who received a 23-year prison sentence, and Shaw, whose cooperation earned him the lesser sentence of 18 years, Santiago was merely a flipper, as Waltice described him, not part of the on-the-ground heroin distribution ring. He pleaded guilty to distributing between 3 and 10 kilos of heroin, which equates to an average of 65,000 shots of the drug, and was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. On the day of his sentencing, Metcalf personally transported him to a federal courthouse in Charlottesville. On the way, Santiago tried to taunt him. He wanted to know if Metcalf had heard about the recent slaying of 2 New York Police Department officers. They'd been ambushed by a Baltimore man who bragged on Instagram that he was putting wings on pigs. Metcalf nodded. Metcalf, you really think you're doing something, don't you? Santiago said. But you ain't changing nothing. This shit ain't going away. Man, I'm just doing my job, Metcalf said. Hell of a thing to take a man away from his family, Santiago said. Yes, it is, Metcalf agreed. Santiago reminded him one more time, there were people out there who were not afraid to put wings on pigs. Jones and Santiago were right, of course. Shit did not stop. That's not the way addiction works. That's not typically how prison reentry plays out. It didn't stop when Dennis Painter's father moved heaven and earth to get him into treatment again in the wake of Jesse Bulstridge's death, only to have him continually pushed through the revolving door of rehab, relapse, and jail. Naming his new baby after Jesse as a reminder didn't stop Dennis's behavior either, nor did the abstinence-only Nashville treatment center his dad sent him to, his 7th attempt to get clean. I've never gone through the stages of grief about Jesse, Dennis told me. He said he tried to kill himself, like 6 times, but it just didn't work. I've just been getting high since it happened. When the Jones-Shaw ring came to a close, Dennis and his friends simply got back on the heroin highway to Baltimore, although in nearby Winchester he could now buy it for $20 a bag, compared with $30 when bought from a runner in Woodstock. I told Dennis that Jesse's mom, Christy, really needed to know what happened the morning that Jesse died. He said, she wants me to vividly describe what I saw when I walked into the bathroom, but she doesn't need that image in her head. He added that he used to go to Jesse's grave, but stopped because it was just too hard. I have a lot of guilt about it. I want to write a letter, get some things off my chest. It feels like if I'd never gone to get the dope that day, he'd still be alive today. Dennis used to spend Thanksgiving at Jesse's house. He, too, had preschool pictures of them at Grasshopper Green. Dennis described the problem exactly as Metcalf had. If OxyContin had been the economic driver in the Appalachian coal fields, then the heroin highway to Baltimore had become one of the few avenues left for America's small-town working class. Can't get a job in a factory? Drive to Baltimore instead. An investment of $4,000 or 50 grams of heroin could earn a person $60,000 in a single week. Don't want to drive all the way to Baltimore? Your returns won't be as high, but you can now drive in just 20 minutes to Little Baltimore, Martinsburg, West Virginia. That's what happens when rural America becomes the new inner city, ranking dead last behind cities, suburbs, and small metro areas in measures of socioeconomic well-being that include college attendance, income, and male labor force participation. Dennis told me they can make all the task forces they want, but they're never going to stop it because the profits are just too great, and the heroin is only getting closer and closer and closer. Dennis's plan, when I talked to him the summer after Santiago went to prison, was to take what some called the geographic cure. He wanted to move to a bigger city with a younger and more ingrained sober living culture, along with better jobs. I've already moved from Strasburg to Middletown, thinking that would help, but I just found people there. Then I moved to Winchester, but I found people who got high there, too. His girlfriend used to hear him talking to himself in the bedroom, but I think he's really talking to Jesse, she told me. His next move, I learned from a sheriff's department Facebook posting was to get hauled back to jail on a probation violation. In his mugshot, Dennis wore an orange jumpsuit, and his eyes were so squinty you couldn't tell they were blue. He was down to 140 pounds from his usual 185. I had just interviewed Dennis's girlfriend, Courtney, the mother of his children. She was attending community college to become a paralegal. Her kids went to a federally funded daycare facility while Dennis's father paid for their housing. She was working at McDonald's in Strasbourg, where Jesse bought his McNuggets on the weekend of his death. One of the low-level dealers in the Jones-Shaw ring, the guy who sold them the heroin that killed Jesse, often showed up at her drive-through window for food.